Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
December 1, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me ramble, and you're going to hear me try and get a hold of my first hour guest in a moment. Again, I've gone to air a little late, but if you're hearing the podcast further on down the stream by your Fondle Slab of choice, your applicable application, or your podcatcher du jour, none of that is going to matter. It is Thursday. So I'm trying to contact Albert Lanier, actually, veteran journalist, to discuss a few things here on the show tonight. But I have not gotten a hold of him so far because when I call him, here's what happens. I get the voicemail. Let's see if that happens right now as I attempt to reach him live on air.
Hi. I'm unable to pick up the phone at the time. Please leave a message and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you very much.
Ah, see this?
At the tone, please record your message. When you finish recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Now, this was pre-scheduled and all that. So, just so you guys know. Mr. Lanier, it's Chuck O'Shelly calling you, and I'm trying to get you. Try and call me back on that 252 number, please. I think it's 301-2255. Don't let anybody else call in as you hear me live out there. That is the Skype number. Thanks. I am live on air, so I'll take your call on air through that number. So there's me hanging up with Albert Lanier. Mike Swanson is off this week, so, you know, he's not going to be with us, and we'll get Mr. Lanier on as soon as we can. But in the second hour, Larry Hancock will join us, and we're going to have a little chat about Russia and what's what regarding the circumstance, the special military action in Ukraine and what's actually happening. We're going to get analysis with Larry Hancock, who is the great author, historian, et cetera, et cetera. But in the meantime, yeah, I was going to talk to Albert Lanier about a few things that I don't normally cover on the show at all. We'll get there. We'll see what happens. I produced Jack Blood's show. Interesting that he's one-eyed Jack today. Got a little bit of an eye problem. Something that I have no familiarity with, so, you know, it is what it is. But anyway, we're gonna get on with this Thursday live thing as quickly as possible and do our thing. Indeed, I might just take a quick break here and try to get us on with our guest, but you just heard me call him, so I'm not making things up. And this was pre-scheduled and all that, and I've been actually putting off Albert Lanier, a bunch of times because of, excuse me, different cancellations and issues with the show and so on and so forth, and my own personal situation, on and on. My mic might be a little hot too. Anyway, maybe I'll take a quick break and get things in order as best I can here on the O'Shelly Effect Thursday. Like I said, if nothing else, I'll ramble at you a little more and see what we can accomplish. But if not, we do have Larry Hancock lined up for hour two. So once I survive this one, I'll get Larry on and we'll talk. And see what else he's got to analyze for us. Maybe even catch up on what happened at the recent JFK Lancer conference where Larry presented an alternative view of Lee Harvey Oswald that I dare say, although I've been trying to encourage people to look in the direction Larry looked, has not been as well examined as could be. Anyway, stay tuned. The O'Shelly Effect will continue after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
In denial. Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Ochelli.com. Support Chuck Ochelli and Chelli.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah, that is
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model too. And look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain, okay? Because people want to support you, they love you to death, but honestly,
so if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show, and I want you to do this because. You know, the Ochelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ochelli.com.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
So we're back to live air, but I have still been unable to contact Mr. Lanier, Albert Lanier, who is a veteran journalist and lives in Hawaii. You know, I was actually hoping to ask him about the volcano that's erupting down there, because I don't know if you noticed that in your news stories as of late, but that is a thing happening. Let's just do a quick cover of a bunch of stuff. Maybe we'll reschedule with Mr. Lanier. It's possible. You know, with all the time changes and fun and games we have with daylight savings, that none of that sank through. Maybe I got a miscommunication on my time. So anyway, it is what it is, and here we are. Look, there's been a lot going on in the news lately, and I haven't had a chance. I did not study up on very much because I was going to talk to Mr. Lanier about a bunch of things that I don't necessarily always follow, including the World Cup controversies. Interesting how they don't want you to be nationalistic when the whole point of it is international competition, right? Like the Olympics, but just for people who want to watch one sport, I guess. I don't know. I'm not that interested in soccer. I find it to be an exceedingly boring game that's very tough to play. I'd rather watch people shoot pool, man. You know, maybe it's just me. But across the world, people disagree with me. And in some places, they call it football and all that good stuff. I mean, what can be said about it? I barely care. But the U.S. recently defeated Iran. Let me get it straight. Just like they corrected the U.S. captain over this. Don't mispronounce my nation. And don't say anything about the, women that were oppressing terribly and all that. Because after all, this is about sports. Don't make it political. But we're all identified by our nation, state, and holding companies as they exist on the international exchanges. Yeah. No contradiction in terms, reality, or the unsporting nature of the sporting event. Pay no attention to any of that. So the U.S. is moving up in that field. I know that Lanier was going to talk about that a bit. He's probably going to now try and call me at 9 p.m. when I've got Larry live, and he's going to disrupt the show by hitting my Skype up. That's probably what's going to happen. Anyway, this is just the luck of the draw lately. So what else could we talk about? The possible rail strike and the potential further disruptions, in the supply chains and the chains which do bind you and do allegedly supply you with all the wonderful things that the wonderful people at Amazon and the master of that universe, Jeff Bezos, could possibly provide you with, despite the fact that he says recently he's going to give away his fortune before he dies. I mean, he might do that just by getting married and divorced a few more times. What else could we discuss? Well, why not Stuart Rhodes talk about a one-eyed Jack, and I forget which eye he put out accidentally with his own firearm once a long time ago, which is why he wears an eye patch. And what is potentially going to occur there where, you know, the media is all excited he might do 60 years for conspiracy to commit sedition, et cetera, et cetera, in the January 6th trial where he has now been found guilty in the court? Well, what do we think about the legitimacy of the courts? I mean, should we go into that today? I don't think so. Let's just hash this out. Is Stuart Rhodes, you know, part of an operation? Is he somebody that is useful to the system? Absolutely, because the people that are going to stand up and shout about the one-eyed man, you know, not the one-armed man like we had in the days of the, what was that again? The Fugitive? Was that the TV show, movie, et cetera, et cetera? Yeah, not the one-armed man, but the one-eyed man who was busted there at the January 6th event, whatever you want to call it, being convicted. Interesting. Could he serve up to 60 years? I doubt anybody's going to put anybody in prison for 60 years when they're so useful to the political theater. So whether he's in on the joke or not, that's where that's going. And I know a lot of people are upset about it right now, but I'm figuring he'll be plenty useful until the return of the allegedly fallen hero, Trump, who is dining out, as Jack focused on, and believe me, I wasn't going to focus on this today, but dining out with, you know, Fuentes, Milo, whatever that Greek name is, Xenophanopoulos, whatever, I don't know. The gay guy who's like an extreme, anti-LGBT guy who was making all kinds of outrageous statements that everywhere he goes causes protests. Yeah, Milo, remember him? He was famous for about 5 minutes last year, or 2 years ago, or 3 years ago. Who knows? Mandela affecting me all over the place. It's all far and wide and gone. What are we dealing with here? Well, Fuentes, Milo, yee! That's right, Kanye was there, because he's quite anti-Semitic lately. And by the by, regardless of the story floating out there, I'm almost thinking that that's not him behind the mask on the Alex Jones show, Although I'm sure that Tim Pool, you know, joined in and wanted to interview Yee. Why not? I would do it right now. I'd talk to him. I have no issues. I mean, look, if you knew my family and many of my friends, and not my listeners, but my family and many of my friends, you would say I'm quite accustomed to dealing with mental patients, so I'd be more than happy to interview Kanye West and ask him how the hell he is making himself into a comic book villain in a really bad comic book, and why it is that he's serving the Trump psyop, why it is that he's doing that oh so well. And meanwhile, there's a dinner at Mar-a-Lago that involves all these interesting figures, and now people can jump that around all over the place. No crime committed there or anything else, because pay no attention to the actual crimes that the servants of the elites commit. Not the servants that are serving them. I don't know what they eat. I mean, I know I've heard that they have this beautiful chocolate cake down there at Mar-a-Lago. But other than that, do you know what else they serve? I mean, outside of BS directly on, you know, allegedly gilded plates, because, you know, Trump loves that golden stuff. I mean, while they're keeping him busy and supposedly maybe going to hand out recommendations to the Justice Department to go further into the investigation and the direct moves against the Trumpster, are they going to do something about that dumpster fire? Is there going to be something done? I don't think so. But stay tuned. I mean, after all, the next season of Coronavirus Apprentice is up and running. And you're going to see his return to Twitter, as I predicted. It took a little longer than I thought, but Elon did reinstate him, and he hasn't actually blown up attention there because he's already breaking the interwebs with just sitting down to dinner with Yee. Well, and this guy Fuentes, who, just like Jack said, I mean, I never heard of this guy before, but there he is. Milo, we heard of. I mean, he even got to go on Bill Maher. What is the point of all this? It's the political theater. You got to build up controversy to promote the next puppet show for 2024. I mean, it's not that exciting that you have the mentally deranged Herschel Walker, who's allegedly a legitimate candidate, and I'm being slammed constantly with, does this man belong in the Senate? Do any of them? Oh, by the way, there's a whole, like, make sure that you're good black people commercial out there, too. And we got Reverend Warnock in there. He needs to get a whole term this time, right? Anyway, I actually might have Albert Lanier on the phone. Let's see when I answer if this is Mr. Lanier, because I've been trying to call him. But as I speak live on the air, I think I might have gotten him. Is that you, sir?
It is me. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. A little trouble connecting to you. It was going right to voicemail.
Yeah, I apologize for that. You know, something happened to my phone. I turned my phone on, and nothing was happening. I wasn't able to call out. I wasn't getting your messages. And I had to turn the phone back on. So,
somebody didn't want you and I to talk today, so they had to directly interfere with your electronics.
I wonder if FIFA was behind this.
Well, you know, did you do anything on Twitter recently? I mean, maybe Elon dispatched some hackers to stop you. Did you have anything negative to say about the...
I didn't,
go ahead, sorry.
I didn't say anything. I didn't promote this just yet. But I will say, to fill in those who are listening, apparently, again, there was a something that hasn't happened. I mean, I've been doing talk shows for, over a decade.
Right.
And I don't think I've ever had this situation occur.
of course not.
It was very strange.
It's okay. Look, we'll get right to the topic now. I'm going to give you a chance, obviously, to tell people where they can go. You have a YouTube channel now, which I don't have anymore, by the way. They took away my YouTube channel. But you have one.
Why is that? If you don't mind me asking, why is that?
You know, basically, there was a whole barrage of complaints against me, apparently, and the final straw was effectively not that I was really directly attacking the vaccine per se, but what happened is I said I don't trust big pharmaceutical companies because the manufacturers have a bad track record of killing people. Yeah, that's apparently a no-no on YouTube.
Oh, yeah. No wonder. That explains it.
Yeah.
You can't. That's a no-go on YouTube.
Right.
Because I've only gone on YouTube as a content creator and a channel owner, as I call it, since this year.
Right.
And, yeah, I know if since this year is the only time I've been on, you can't talk about the pandemic or any other aspect therein, or unless you're a medical expert, or even if you're a medical expert, you got to be careful.
Right.
They don't allow that. So.
And sadly, I had a channel since 2008. Right. You know, so I was there for a long time, but apparently this was the thing I could not do. And I've been responsible. I'm a responsible broadcaster. I don't even like to curse or any of that stuff, which you can do on YouTube. But I don't do any of that, you know? Anyway.
Right.
That's what happened to me.
Well, that's a whole other subject. You know, I would have to. Well, you know, the thing is, I gotta get a new phone anyway, and it's obvious why I have to get a new
phone. Fair enough. But
so
look,
I just want to say to, for the first time ever, apologize for the tardiness, to the audience out there. It's never happened in over a decade.
Well, no problem at all.
Podcast and talk show. So I apologize to the audience.
No, listen,
we acted up. It was a weird situation.
Yeah,
I couldn't get your messages. Finally did, and then I couldn't. Call out. It was frustrating.
It's okay. Look, you know what? We've got about 30 minutes to work with, and that's fine because I need you to fill me in. I am not, and I mentioned it because I did sort of an impromptu news rundown here while I was trying to raise you on the phone. And, you know, the thing is, I said at the very beginning of it, look, I'm not a great follower of sports anymore. I used to be. But I was never a big fan of, you know, what I call soccer and what much of the world calls football. But there has been some political intrigue, some controversy here. And even if you're not a sports guy, you might be paying attention to this stuff. And I know that you as an independent journalist, I mean, look, you've covered many things. And I assume you've covered sports before. Matter of fact, I think we talked about that. Yeah.
I covered boxing. I covered a couple of boxing matches. I have to be brutally honest. I was never a sports. Among the things I covered, sports was not really one of them. I did a couple boxing matches for some reason for ethnic newspapers I was writing for.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed a couple of boxers. But that was really about it. That's the extent of it in terms of my extent in covering any kind of sports or a sport as a reporter, as a journal, when I was a freelance journalist, when I was a print journalist.
Right.
So it's limited for me, but with, you know, it's near the end of the year. I'm kind of finishing up on my, my talk show and my podcast, bookings. And I thought with the way things are, you know, had this been earlier, I would have talked about what went on in the UK and everything. But I thought with the World Cup, I thought this is different because of this particular World Cup and what's gone on in the past few years of the World Cup. I thought perfect opportunity to talk a little about sports. But this isn't just about sports. It's also about politics. It's also about economics. It's also about money, crime, I would say, and corruption. And it's also about, I think it's also about business. So I think it encompasses a variety of things, interestingly enough. Now, the World Cup, for those who are probably now well aware, is what I would call the Olympics of one sport. You know, the Olympics are every 4 years. The World Cup is also every 4 years. It has been since 1930. The modern Olympics, I think, since the late 19th century. But what I call what is called the World Cup of football, soccer in the U.S. I call it the Olympics of football, which is basically what it is. No other sport has the global reach and the global power that football has. And when I say football, I do not mean NFL football, American football. I mean global football. What is known in the U.S. is soccer. And so I'll be referring to that as football. It may confuse some people, a lot of people in the States, but other people will know what I'm talking about if this is heard outside the country. Mm-hmm. So we're here. We have a World Cup that's going on right now. It's supposed to go on until about, I think, December 18, maybe the final match or the World Cup finals. And the World Cup is administered by FIFA, which is a international organization that basically runs this form of professional soccer in the States, professional football, right? Now, people are probably wondering, if they've heard me on the show, why am I talking about sports? As I mentioned before, I think the World Cup going on is a big story. You're seeing a lot of TV segments, news segments about it, whether it's on, you know, broadcast television or online TV. I think this particular World Cup stands out because of the host country. And the host country is a country called Qatar. Now, Qatar is a Gulf state that's close to Saudi Arabia, just out into the Gulf, the ocean, to the Gulf, there in the middle, in the Mideast region, right? And when we... Qatar is a country that, if you look at its census, it's about 3 million people. But that's disarming because more than 2 million of those people are essentially foreign workers. And thousands upon thousands of those people are migrant workers. You have a population of basically a homegrown population in Qatar, largely of over 300,000. So the country itself is relatively small.
Right. Now,
a country that, of course,
Let me interrupt you here with something, because we have had to discuss, Qatar or Gutter, you know, depending on how you pronounce it, on the show before, because they have been an emergent, let's call them presence in the media over the past, say, decade and a half or two decades, where they have grown from some place that nobody knew about at all throughout the world into something else. And politics, because of the international nature of FIFA and the event in and of itself, and the nationalism which is built into it, which, by the way, I brought up the whole similarity to the Olympics, but only for one sport, before you got on. You didn't hear that, but I was doing that too. The thing is, it's inexorably linked politically. There must be politics involved, because you have an international organization that goes to different countries and then brings nationalist representing elements into a foreign nation. Now, it's been a little more controversial because in Gutter you have, you know, again, this immigrant population you're talking about that did a lot of work, which miraculously almost built the facilities for this, made it possible, and all of that. So there's been a controversy about the creation of this event. There's been a controversy about who's been allowed to participate in this event. International visitors, how will they be treated? Because there are various social issues involved here. The treatment of the LGBT community in, any of the Muslim nations, honestly, is at issue always, right? So you have all of that, plus the international politics. I mean, to the point where the USA team captain is at a press conference and being corrected about saying Iran versus Iran, right? Oh, by the way, did our guys sing the national anthem? We have the unrest in Iran. And all of that culminating in a match that, you know, the USA, more as an underdog, it seemed like, came in and defeated them to move on to the next round. And there was the aspect of sportsmanship, and what does this mean politically, and does this mean more attention will be paid to this uprising, as it's being described there in Iran. So a lot of things are in play here. Even though there's always been politics here, it seems like it got even more heated. And again, even if you're not a sports person, you got to recognize that there's this interplay of the international body politic that is now completely involved in what is, again, a nationalistic, because everybody's there under a flag, right? They're not there because they're the Jaguars and the Wolves and whatever random corporate title could be attached to them. They're representing their nation, just like the Olympics, where, you know, there's supposed to be a certain standard and all that. So there's a lot to get through here.
Yeah. Go ahead, sir.
No, no, I'm just saying, that's why there's so much here to work with, right?
Yeah, that's why I called it the Olympics of football. Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, World Cup stands out from any other kind of sporting event, including in the U.S., the Super Bowl, or the World Series, or the NBA Finals, which are the big sporting finalist events in championship events in this country. And it stands out because of the size and the scope and the political ramifications, right? As you mentioned, people are competing for their country. These are national teams. So that's why I call it the Olympics of football. Mm-hmm. And that's why it kind of stands out compared to other sports. Now, let's go back. When we talk about why you see all these news segments and all of these articles and all these pieces written about Qatar as the host of the World Cup this year in 2022, let's go back to December 2nd, 2010, in Switzerland. Now, Qatar was one of the bidders for the 2022 World Cup. Among them were the United States and Australia and a couple of other nations. Now, the fact that Qatar won the right to host the World Cup was considered completely shocking to people. Now, you have to understand, this is, as I mentioned before, a very small Gulf state, actual population over 300,000 people, over 2 million migrant workers and other kinds of workers and employees coming in to work in Qatar. This is a country that at the time had one stadium, a team that had never qualified for the World Cup, and was now is nowhere near even, I would argue, a mediocre team, let alone a decent team. They didn't seem to have even the facility. Mm-hmm. So in 10 years, they got it in December of 2010. Since 2010, what they did was they had all of these migrant workers that came from places like India and Nepal and Bangladesh and some African nations and other nations. They had these workers help build at least 7 new stadiums, dozens of new hotels, a new highway, and a new airport, as well as a brand new metro or train system. This small little speck of a country that didn't even have anywhere near the facilities, didn't have anywhere near the profile of a football even loving nation,
right?
Or a nation that would be congenital football. And I haven't even gotten to the basics of Qatar. Qatar is an emirate, meaning a monarchy. It's ruled by an emir called Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani.
Right.
And basically, like most other Gulf states, these are essentially rather iron-fisted monarchies, where the rule of the emir or the rule of the monarch goes. Of course, being a Islamic nation, alcohol is not sold in most places in Qatar, and this has become a controversy in regards to the World Cup, because you had Budweiser, one of the sponsors, that paid millions of dollars to be a sponsor there, and they were looking to sell alcohol. And the Qataris were going to allow that to an extent for the World Cup, but then reneged. Now, I don't know if they have gone back on that. I'm not sure if they have gone back and decided to do that right now. but at one point they did renege. And so you have this country that is very, is, by any definition, compared to a lot of the nations where football is a dominant or one of the dominant sports, like many European nations and even South American nations, which have always been sort of the hot spots, to use an internet phrase, an old internet phrase, the hot spots for football globally. It's been Europe and South America. In fact, Uruguay was the first nation to host the World Cup in 1930. And they had, were actually fairly successful, football power unto themselves, successful country in regards to football. And so when you have a country that is, like a lot of these Gulf states, very ruled by a monarchy and ruled with very, very strict rules that where religion and politics are don't just intertwine, they're almost inseparable. As I mentioned, alcohol. For example, public drunkenness is not allowed. It's a crime. No. You also have the fact that being gay in Qatar is a crime. It's criminalized. People can go to prison for 7 years. Also criminalized is any kind of sex outside of the marital arrangement. That's also everything comparable to anyone found engaging in that activity would face a strict, that kind of sentence possibly. They might also get lashes, like corporal public punishment. And so this is an extremely, extremely strict nation.
Right.
And not, this is not just to mention that, of course, like in many Gulf states, the idea of legal, total legal and political rights for women is almost non-existent. Mm. It's almost non-existent. So Qatar was not an ideal, not only not an ideal place in which to have a World Cup, it didn't even come close to being half a place to have the World Cup. So people were perfectly, a lot of countries were outraged, right? Of course, the Qataris, from what's reported, had offered something along the order of $200 million as a bid, like different countries of a bidding process in regards to the World Cup. I think American, the U.S. delegation and the U.S. offered about $5 million. They were offering $200 million reportedly, and they were pledging to build all of these facilities, which they have.
Right.
Which they have. I mean, they've almost completely created a, I would call it, but I basically would call, they've created this sort of, you know, metropolis in the desert there. Basically, Qatar is looking to use the World Cup as a springboard to become a major business center. In my view, what the Qataris want to do is become sort of the Hong Kong of the Middle East.
Well, and they are currently, just so you know, they're currently running international commercials now, touting themselves as a, you know, a brand new place where people should go, much like they did with Abu Dhabi a couple of years ago, much like they did with, Saudi Arabia even more recently, where they're trying to present it as, look, this is a good place for you to bring your international corporation. This is a good place for you to set up business. This is a good place for you to visit as a tourist. We are an emergent nation that is ready and willing to work with the international community to be a place, to be a destination, to be a resort, to be all of it, all at once. And again, as you said, you're talking about they basically manufactured more than what average cities have in many other countries within 10 years, which, by the way, just try and get, you know, a railway project done in an American city in 10 years, right? You right. know, and they built, like,
well,
you said,
never happened. You couldn't do this in the United States.
No. And part of it,
even parts of Europe.
Right. Even parts of Europe, it would be almost impossible. And part of it, the controversy already, is due to the fact that you have this migrant, as you said, this, you know, immigrate labor force, which comes into the country. And by the way, the treatment of that labor force has also been called into question. What kind of conditions they were working in, what their pay is, everything else. But regardless of all of it, they completed construction ahead of schedule and delivered on what it was they promised. Not only the bid, but all the facilities are apparently intact and working, and all the infrastructure, which they built in the desert. I mean, let's be blunt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well,
yes, you know, the price tag is somewhere that I've seen reported is $300 billion in infrastructure that spent, I believe, was spent for this World Cup, or at least in preparation for this World Cup.
Right.
$300 billion reportedly. And their bid was like $200 million, at least. So they're looking, the Qataris are obviously looking for a big payday. Now, as you mentioned, the migrant worker population, the immigrant worker population, was responsible to a great extent for building all of these new stadiums, the airport, the metro, the highways, the hotels. But of course, this is a population that has, even at this point, although the Qataris say they have done, made reforms, they have virtually, well, not virtually, I would say actually no rights in that country. And this was primarily because of the kafala system, which was a sponsorship system, in which basically the employer, which would be Qatari Match, would basically have almost total control over workers. Mm-hmm. These foreign workers have passports taken from them. They are put into these migrant worker camps, which have the most appalling, disgusting conditions, sometimes little to no cooking facilities, bathrooms that have effluence and you know, bad to, you know, substandard drainage, you know, basically modest living arrangements. Well, I don't even say modest. I'm being kind if I say modest.
No, these are people jammed into cramped dorms in most cases, where even the media has attempted to go take a look at it. They're not allowed to see most of the facilities. You got situations here where you can't even change jobs or take a break or do anything without the permission of your employer, who does control every single thing you do. You can't leave. Okay, you are captive as a, I mean, I don't know what else to describe it as, but you're a captive when you sign on, when you go there. And these are people from many vulnerable nations where they are desperate for work. They're going there to better themselves. They're not paid extremely well. And again, even the work conditions where, you know, we heard a little bit of worry about how hot it would be for the players and this and that during the World Cup. The people building the stadiums didn't get that kind of consideration. They were working in temperatures that were sometimes in excess of 120 degrees Fahrenheit for 12 and 14 hours at a time, which is over hard labor.
Celsius. Okay. It's intolerable conditions.
Right.
For any, I mean, if this were done in the United States, it would be, you know, just flatly illegal. And they're working in these extremely, horrifically hot conditions, building these facilities.
Right.
And they're stuck because of the kafala system, where a number of these people, a lot of these workers came from places like Bangladesh or Nepal or even India to a certain extent. They were paying money to these brokers or these individuals, sometimes in addition to like 4,000 bucks, I guess, comparable to U.S. Right. And then when they get there, you know, they got to pay that money back. And they get their passport taken from them. They're stuck in these facilities. That's, and you talked about pay, that's if they get paid.
Mm-hmm.
That's if they get paid. A number of these workers didn't get paid. So they're working and not receiving any money. They're not receiving any compensation for their labor. Again, virtual slave labor. Now, again, you look at what it took to create these facilities for this World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
The reports are, I think, according to The Guardian, was that at least 6,000 people have died, migrant workers have died, or workers have died, in the time from over a period of years. I mean, this is a staggering death toll, staggering death toll. Of course, the Qataris argue that it's a much smaller number. I think it's, their numbers are, I think, less than 100, I believe.
Well, and here's the problem, even... And here's another problem. International agencies, which have attempted to get the data to accurately report the body count, even, Mr. Lanier, there is controversy over that. You're citing a number of 6,000. It is possible, or 6,500. It's possible we're looking at a much higher body count than that. We don't know, indeed, because you're not allowed to see the records, whatever records have been kept by the individual who's in charge of that. I saw an interview with that guy, with an English speaking outlet. I think maybe a BBC reporter tried to discuss it with him. And pretty much all he reported is what you just said, that, listen, the number's not that high. And then the guy ended the interview, which, you know, honestly is not a good look right. when you're being questioned about how many people died to build these facilities. You know, right. I'm just saying, I'm not saying that I know the answer, but it doesn't look good, does it?
No, and it hasn't looked good for Qatar. And it also doesn't look good for FIFA, which is the organization that administered the World Cup. And FIFA, let's be honest, FIFA's an organization. Now, John Oliver, who is a comedian, not a journalist, but he's a comedian who does the show Last Week Tonight on HBO, but whose show is often jam-packed full of the kind of facts that you would find in a news article or an op-ed, described FIFA in a segment that he ran on the show as, quote, a cartel-like group of scumbags and criminals who occasionally put on soccer matches. Now, let me just state, this is what John Oliver thinks of FIFA. How I would describe FIFA is the guardians of soccer, or the guardians of global football. And I would call them corrupt and corrupt guardians for hire and for sale of football. The corrupt guardians of football who are for hire, who are for sale.
Well, let me depart from your description just a touch to say just this, because we're going to run out of time really quickly here, and I want you to get to... unfortunately, it took a little time to get you today, but I want you to wrap a bow around this. But here's the thing. This is a criminal organization, and I say that confidently because even recently they had to police themselves. They had to remove leadership from their own organization for all sorts of corruption themselves. So we know that we're dealing with a corrupt organization that is clearly not that concerned with human rights abuses or anything else. They are the civilized base of a lot of brutal activity and a lot of mistreatment of people. And yes, occasionally, every 4 years that is, they put on a soccer tournament. That's how I would describe it, Mr. Lanier. Now, you might disagree, but that's how I see it. Go ahead.
Well, I think they're a corrupt organization, and at this point criminal because of the investigations that went on in 2015. Of course, the U.S. Justice Department and U.S. law enforcement were involved, federal law enforcement were involved. The problem with FIFA in many respects, and FIFA is an organization that started in 1904, and it's basically composed of a sort of Congress of officials. It's the FIFA Congress. And at this point, over the years, it's grown. The first World Cup was in 1930. Now we have the World Cup here in 2022. It's grown. By the 80s, it was about over 170 countries, or about 170 countries. And they were organized globally into what were known as confederations. So you have the Congress and these confederations. At the top of the FIFA hierarchy, the organizational hierarchy, is what is known as XCOM, which is composed of about 24 individuals, the top, including the president, the top leadership there. It's known as EXCO, right? The Executive Committee, or EXCO. Mm-hmm. EXCO by 1964, they were able to essentially be the sole decision-making factor within FIFA that chose the World Cup. And this really opened up the organization to corruption. Because essentially what would happen is these 24 officials, which were all men, I believe they're still all men largely, would be accorded all kinds of privileges, meetings with prime ministers and presidents, and maybe members of monarchies, all kinds of luxurious trips, basically treated lavishly and paid quite well too. And so Exco made a lot of the decisions until relatively recently, and this is where a lot of the corruption came from. And this is a pattern within FIFA. I hate to say that what happened with Qatar really wasn't it wasn't a misnomer. It wasn't an outlier. There were questions about other decisions. For example, in the same year that that Qatar was chosen, it was also Russia for the 2018 World Cup. There were questions about influence by Russian officials on FIFA officials in regards to that decision. You also had decisions about the choice of Germany to host in 2006 and South Africa in 2010 and possibly even the 1998 World Cup. So this pattern of corruption has been going on for decades in FIFA, for decades. You know, its past president, Yao Havelange, had taken, I think accordingly, about maybe over $1 million in bribes and was said to be openly corrupt. So there's a pattern of corruption that has existed for decades within FIFA. Like I said, this organization is basically, as I mentioned, the corrupt guardians of football. These guardians are for hire, and this is engaged in what I would call a pay-to-play aspect. So their votes of the Exco members, supposedly it's moved back to the overall Congress to make the decisions now in regards to World Cup hosts in the future.
Right.
But these decisions that were made by Exco were clearly made for payola, were mainly made for bribes. They were made for pay. And that's the nature of this organization. So when we look at the World Cup, and we look at everything, it's not just Qatar. I don't want to be fair to Qatar. We know what their abuses are. We know what their nation is like. But it's also the pattern that has existed historically with FIFA.
Right.
Which is perhaps one of the most corrupt sports organizations on the planet. One of the most corrupt sporting organizations on the planet. And Exco led all that because they held the purse strings. They were the ones that funded, that sent money out to different organizations to fund tournaments and youth programs and so forth.
Right.
So we see this kind of confluence going on.
Mm-hmm.
What Qatar ended up being was the perfect storm that helped expose the long-time corruption that occurred in FIFA, both within FIFA and outside of FIFA.
And it is amazing. Albert Lanier, veteran journalist with me, veteran freelance journalist. He's been on the show several times. But this is an interesting topic because, again, it is picking at a scab that eventually reveals a lot of pus. I mean, I'm sorry to put it that way, but this is what we got. You and I have discussed boxing briefly on the show before, and certainly boxing is a dirty business and is an international business. But I don't think anything compares to the massive organization that we're looking at. I mean, think about the figures we're talking about, right? I mean, when you have a massive boxing gate and somebody gets paid $50 million and this and that, and the pay-per-view goes out for this many million, what are we looking at? A couple hundred million dollars. Meanwhile, that's just the starting bid that a country like Qatar gets to put in, right? It covers the starting bid for what becomes a massive international laundering operation. And in this case, it's not to launder money. It's to launder the reputation and the profile of nations. It's a much larger thing. I'm just saying, you know, people talk about the dirty business of boxing. And agreed, it's dirty. But it is nowhere near the gargantuan size that this is, right? So I want you to make a final comment about that and then tell people where they can find you. I mean, obviously, we're going to give you guys a link to Albert Lanier's YouTube channel, which has a fascinating piece on there about, you know, how to be a journalist and stuff like this. There's a lot of interesting stuff up there. I'm a little angry because I'm not on YouTube anymore, but Albert Lanier still is. It's okay. I don't begrudge anybody.
Well, I'm really new to YouTube. So my YouTube channel, let me just wrap this up by saying, it just tells you a lot. You're right about boxing, but boxing's relatively easy to fix, right, compared to some other sports. One official for FIFA noted that, quote, less democracy is sometimes better for organizing a World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells you a lot about the mindset and the framework in which FIFA and this World Cup and other World Cups have been organized.
Right.
Now, if you want to find me, I have a still new channel. It's called Writer Albert Lanier. It's on YouTube. There are shows there, freelance, to deal with freelance writing and other kind of writing. And I have a true crime show. This is all kind of very basic stuff. I'm just doing this in my apartment. So there's no fancy graphics or titles or music, just straightforward, called Looking Into. So I do a true crime kind of short form series called Looking Into.
Okay.
And I need to do a couple of those soon. But I do a show, I do something called Looking Into, which is short form. It's like 10, 15, 20 minutes or so.
Right.
And I also have other content there that's all related to writing and writers. So
yes.
That's YouTube, and the name of the channel is Writer Albert Lanier. That's Writer Albert Lanier. L-A-N-I-E-R. A-L-B-E-R-T.
That's it. Writer L-A-L. Albert Lanier on YouTube, but I'll also give you guys links to some of the stuff that he's written recently or more recently than his earlier career, because he kind of went into semi-retirement and then was writing on, what was it, Medium and Substack, I think, for a minute there.
Medium, right. I had a blog on Medium for 4 years.
Right, a blog on Medium for 4 years, but this YouTube channel, and I'll tell you, if you want to get into some true crime stuff, who knows, maybe I could assist you a little on a couple of things. Because
if you want to do a true, you know, if you want me to come back and do, you know, do a true crime episode?
Yeah, sure.
Do that. I know we can cook. Why don't we do that? I guess the next time I'll come, why don't we do one of those?
I would love to do that with you, and obviously you could repost it or use it on YouTube, because that's the only way I'm getting on there is if somebody else puts something else up of me. So why not?
I haven't said out yet.
I promise I'll keep my controversial comments to myself, okay? And we can just deal with the material at hand. But Albert Lanier, kind All of right. a shortened segment, but I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Glad everything worked out.
Absolutely. In the next hour, we'll be talking to author, researcher Larry Hancock, and we're going to discuss something else. Maybe we'll get into Russia and Ukraine and all that with the historian, author, and analyst.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs, and nation building in Southeast Asia. By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs, and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
Support Chuck O'Chili at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model, too. And, look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly.
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this, too, because, you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Chili.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Okay, technically the third segment, but second hour of the Ocelli Effect. Now here on a Thursday, and very, very grateful to have back with us Larry Hancock. Of course, you should know Larry. If you listen to my show, you know who Larry Hancock is, for God's sake. I've said it 100 times. I've got more of his books on my shelf than any other author, for a good reason, because he is a great composer of these things, first of all. But secondly, you know, informative, especially about the national security state, the behaviors thereof, whether we're talking about regarding, oh, what is the new term for it? UFOs, now they're UAPs, right? Okay. Whether it's that in the book Unidentified, or it is, you know, someone would have talked. His recent presentation at Lancer regarding Lee Harvey Oswald, which went in a direction that I am extremely encouraged by, because it is indeed the direction that I have been encouraging people to go in, but, you know, whoever listens to me. So it's very interesting, an alternative view of that particular character in history. And I have a great appreciation for that, along with David Boylan, which I'm never sure if I pronounce his name right, But you guys both talking about New Orleans and Oswald and really a new look at some things that should be old hat, but maybe weren't examined quite as honestly and objectively as they should have been. But anyway, that's an aside. Do we talk about that? Do we talk about surprise attack? Do we talk about Killing King, the awful grace of God? Do we talk about creating chaos? Well, today we will, because I want to ask Larry, especially because we have missed him in this time when the conflict has gone on in Ukraine and what are they calling it again? The special military operation, right? Or the war in Ukraine. And by the way, get it straight, because after all, for some reason, for political reasons, and I said for some reason, and then I said for political reasons, and again, you can ask that open question and still declare it politics, because we live in a strange land nowadays. There are people that want to declare Vladimir Putin a good guy, and the denazification is all legitimate, and what's going on? Now they're knocking out the power grid a bit, and it's going to be very cold in Ukraine. And this has gone on, and this is a controversy. And even yesterday when we saw the French President Macron, right, standing there with Biden, or was that today? You know, it blurs together. Discussing how, gee, it's great that the United States has stepped up and been a real honest partner with Ukraine, and still the resistance of something that should have been ended in a couple of days is kind of in and out of the headlines. Is it really something that is important? Well, they tell us it might be affecting us on the food supplies. They tell us it might be affecting our fuel costs. They tell us a lot of things about this, but they don't really, outside of the propaganda war, that either Putin is a hero or he is a villain and there is no other answer in between. They often seem to forget that he was an intelligence operative, and there is nobody that that I know that will discuss this more rationally, okay, more coherently, at least among people I know, than Larry Hancock. So, Larry, first of all, yeah, it's great to have you. I'm looking forward to just kind of getting an analytical catch-up from you on this, because things have changed since the last time we discussed this, and yet they remain the same. So, you know, first, I'm glad you're with us, and I asked you how you were feeling before we went to air, so I know the answer to that question, but I'm sure inquiring minds out there would like to know how you're doing, so you could tell us that, and then let's jump into the subject. Larry, how you doing tonight?
The health is good. My recovery from the heart surgery has gone well, so I'm really happy about that part, and pretty much back to normal. Back to the point where I can even work on multiple projects at the same time. So that can be especially, you know, I guess a good marker.
Right. And you sound good. I got to say, you actually sound like the old energetic Larry that I know oh so well. And I hope you're going to go to Dallas in 2023, because apparently they're doing the in-person conference again. And I'm asking anybody that might be interested if they're going, because I think there might be a little carpool of Ocelli Effect people showing up, including myself. So,
oh, that sounds good, and I think there's a strong chance of that. It would be hard to miss the 60th anniversary, especially, you know, with some initiative developing on the records release front, and it's no longer an abandoned subject, and I think will resurface as a real subject of interest and for the 60th about a year from now.
Yeah, I know. I agree. I think there's going to be a bit of a media push in all corridors of the media, and I think it'll be a good time, especially if progress is made, because there's a current lawsuit, as we got a lot of details from, I think it was Larry Schnapp's presentation at Lancer. I'm sure you saw that. Where he laid out a whole lot of things that were going on. I found it fascinating that recently they discussed this oversight committee and how they had to meet about certain things. And in the news reports, it was funny because I knew that they were literally talking about the very same people that had to meet for the JFK stuff. Also, they had other business on the agenda. It wasn't the only thing they met about. But it was funny, like, they left that out of the news story recently, and I said, you know what? I happen to know that they had to discuss JFK Records stuff there too. And it was just really interesting. But anyway, we're not here to do JFK tonight. I want to just leave it open and get your analysis about what we're looking at here, because clearly there is a variety of intelligence operations which have emerged. Now, to play catch up again, we could be looking at the alleged assassination that might have been carried out by Ukrainian operatives against one of Putin's guys that turned out to take out his daughter, right? There was that went on, and there you go, a little bit of political assassination. Of course, it's not the head of a state, but it is a significant figure, and that goes on. We know about that. But the controversy over that sort of evaporated. The controversy over what is Putin's plan and what's really going on and what's happening and how is the pushback going in his own nation and all of this. How would you unpack this for somebody who's totally confused by what it is they're seeing in the news?
Well, I think there are two aspects that you have to, as you say, unpack. First of all, it's no longer all about Putin. It's all about the power structure in Russia. If the special military operation had gone as Putin conceived it, it would have been one thing. And it would have been over and done with, and Putin would have continued with his overall geopolitical ambitions, as we've seen reflected in Georgia, as we've seen reflected in Belarus. I mean, he had a geopolitical agenda to restore a Russian sphere of influence, and Ukraine could have just been one of the stops along the way on that. That's gone. That didn't happen. Russia has become so mired down in Ukraine that just as of today, if you were a Russian citizen, it is now illegal to even talk about the Russian military, even in support of the Russian military. They have put virtually any conversation about the Russian military off limits in social media, in public. You certainly can't talk about the war. In fact, they're even shutting down a number of their military bloggers who have been extremely supportive of the war, whatever you want to call it, but critical of the Russian military.
Right.
That's a big step, because that, by taking that off the plate, that effectively communicates to the Russian public, you know, it's sort of like the old Soviet strategy. If it's not news, it must be news, right? We understand these people well enough to know if they're not talking about it, it's noteworthy. And they're smart enough to know that, and to know things are going badly.
Well, let me interrupt you with a question right there. Because do you think that this is an effort to sanitize the circumstance publicly so that, even though, like you said, they're shutting down basically pro-Russian speakers of all sorts that are on the side of this, right? Whatever it is you want to call it. They're on the side of it, but maybe they're criticizing the behavior of the Russian military a little bit. Okay, maybe they don't want any criticism whatsoever. I think the greater issue, though, that might be at play, and I want to know what your opinion is that they want to sanitize it, because there were literally soldiers that were going to social media complaining about the conditions and things like this, and they were doing that independently. And I think that a total shutdown eliminates any of that sort of embarrassment for the overall crusade. And yes, I am using that loaded word for a reason, because there is a religious aspect to this. And I think a lot of the talking heads, Larry, and I know you're not afraid to touch this, but a lot of the talking heads who are breaking this down politically, socially, historically, they are, many of them, in fear of discussing the religiosity here that is connected to the Russian Orthodox Church. But let's put a pin in that for a moment.
And that really was going to be my second area of interest. So, but actually, my take on the shutdown of the communication, certainly what you say is part of it, to eliminate some of the terrible headlines. But you really can't do that entirely when you have a, you know, a mother's march telling Putin how bad things are, or, you know, committees going to the regional heads of the oblast telling them what they're hearing from there. You know, you can't. What I think it more reflects is, and I think this is interesting, that's the sort of order that has to come from Putin.
Right.
Because it comes from Putin, it's executed by the FSB, Federal Security Organization. It's a Putin order. And one of the things that is interesting about it is that a lot of the military criticism that has been coming into the social media literally has been either from two points of power, the Chechen leadership, who sent a lot of Chechen forces into Ukraine, this kind of rogue military commander who Putin has turned into a general, and from the commander of the Wagner Group, both of whom have positioned themselves in competition with Putin. As it turns out, a lot of the negative commentary about the Russian combat experience in Ukraine has been coming out of the Wagner Group and the Wagner Group sites on social media. Basically, the Wagner Group has put itself in competition with the Russian military. And we're not just talking about socially. We know that there are incidents where Wagner military personnel have killed Russian commanders because they don't see themselves as underneath the Russian army. The Wagner Group has been literally terrorizing mobilized soldiers and taking supplies and weapons away from them and keeping the bottom line is that's I think what you're seeing is an effort for Putin to try to main control of the dialogue and diminish some of the criticism that's coming from his potential competitors.
Well, help out the listener a little bit, maybe who hasn't heard of these different factions, because generally speaking, what's reported in Western media is that you're dealing with a quite unified, you know, the Russian bear in and of itself, right? It's this big unified military threat. It's a large military. It's fairly well equipped. Then maybe there were some stories it wasn't well equipped, but at the same time they had nuclear options, so on and so forth. I mean, a terrifying force attacking something about the size of Texas, should have by overwhelming numbers and technologies and access to resources been able to accomplish this. And yet there is this element of infighting that I think nobody's really laid out. So could you help out somebody who says, wait a minute, I didn't hear about these other factions before. Could you describe them and how they differ from the standard military, which also there was the mobilization while you were absent that occurred, the calling up of troops and all that. It's not the homogenous group that we've been led to believe, though, is it?
It's not homogenous either from a command standpoint, or one of the reasons the Russian army was assumed to be so dominant and so powerful was something that's called combined arms, the ability to integrate air and land and sea into combined operations. Mm-hmm. It was felt that the Russians had spent a great deal of money on command and control infrastructures, communications, cyber warfare that would make them truly a modern military force in the same way that NATO is, or that the U.S. is, or that China is.
And been shown to be deadly efficient in places like Syria to accomplish what it is they seem to set out to do. So not fully untested yet, but not fully tested either. This modernization, this move toward this, it's not been demonstrated really, but it was assumed, right? Or am I wrong about that?
I think it was assumed because in Syria, for example, we only saw one element of the combined arms, really. We saw their air power. And it's sort of like the U.S. in Afghanistan or the U.A., you know, when you have a totally dominant element of your military and there's no opposition to it, you can look really dramatically effective. Mm-hmm. I mean, so they did in Syria. And in Syria, they pretty much let the regime ground forces carry the ball, but they conducted a brutal bombing campaign. The same thing they're trying to do in Ukraine now. And the opposition forces in Syria had nothing to throw back at them. So they could essentially wipe out civilian infrastructure at will. Mm-hmm. So they looked very deadly and very superior. It's when you take that same force and put it against an adversary that has some ability to fight back on all three elements that you really test it. And the bottom line is the Russian military has failed that test to a large extent. Now, one of the problems, of course, as we talked about earlier, Chuck, is they weren't – all your military plans are really built around your assumptions. And mm-hmm. Putin gave them a totally false set of assumptions, right? The Ukrainians will roll over. They really like Russia. They're being suppressed by Kiev. You know, all you guys have to do is this. Well, that's what they did. And he was pretty much wrong about everything with that tasking. And they've had to totally revise their whole war plan. I guess what I'm trying to – first off, we have to characterize and look at really what happened to the Russian military. And the Russian military has taken their lumps because of their failure to go to combine – to effect, execute combined tactical action, mm-hmm. because of the weakness of their command and control chain and the lack of a mid-level command at the – of experienced captains, majors, whatever. So, the Russian military has had a very difficult time. Well, guess what? That offered the opportunity for the Chechen fighters and the Wagner forces, who are mercenary forces, and in start, who were quite experienced and quite well trained and well equipped, far more so than the average Russian army troop, mm-hmm. to go in and really be brutal and successful and to essentially make a case that the Russian army was poorly led and didn't have fighting spirit, you know, and if we were in charge, it would be a whole new ball game. And that's where you had what was evolving among the Russian pro-war military bloggers were quite supportive of the Chechen forces and the Wagner group, and quite dismissive of the Russian army chain of command. And mm-hmm. when you look at the fact that Putin has canned like 12 generals in charge of the war in a row, the fact that the Russian Navy is pretty much bottled up in Sevastopol, you know, they've got to a point where all they can do is launch missiles, really, and fight some trench warfare. So these other people were in a position to make a pretty good power play, maybe not against Putin, but against the Russian army. The Russian army doesn't take that well. And quite frankly, it is the Russian army, the Russian armed forces, that are, you know, that's Putin's base. You know, that's who he put in charge of this. So back to our discussion, I think the suppression of criticism, certainly, it's to help control the public groundswell of opposition to the war, but it also, to some extent, protects the institutions, the Russian army, Putin's administration. It protects him at the same time.
Hmm. See, now I've actually got just two really treacherous questions for you now. Okay.
Thank you, Chuck.
And I know that these are a whole lot of fun and they're filled with loads of potholes, but I'm fully confident you, Larry Hancock, can handle them. So here we go. Do you think it is possible that we are looking at, once again, what I would refer to often as the folly or the fallacy of empire, where, much like the United States going into Vietnam thinking that they could easily subdue a small country because they are a great military power, much like the Soviet Union felt going into Afghanistan. Oh, wait a minute, one other time into Afghanistan with the United States. In modern times, it seems as though a large military power will often get themselves bogged down into a war that they have a strategy going into, and it doesn't work out according to plan at all. Okay, and you have a much more difficult insurgent force that is native to the land, that is, you know, has been misrepresented, okay, to the people that you sent there to fight, whether it's the command and control or the soldiers on the ground or all the above. And yet this is a repeated mistake of larger military powers. I mean, am I seeing something that's not there, or is this something to be understood? The repeated mistake. I mean, much like when you covered this in your one book, right, about, you know, military, well, paramilitary and, you know, covert operations, you know, and how it is that the United States seemed to make the same mistakes over and over again. And now other countries finally learned from them, and they're doing it maybe even better. Maybe. Okay. How is it that it seems as though the empire or the larger military, I think of them as, you know, as empires. Okay. I really do see it this way. When they come in to one of these smaller nation states, they never seem to, no matter what the level of intelligence they should have is, no matter how they should know it, or they have, you know, common ground that they try to reach, they go in to win the hearts and minds, and they find out that they don't really know the hearts and minds of those people, and they find that they're faced with an enemy now that they did not fully understand, and there is another adjustment that needs to be made, and another, and still, the larger military power, which on paper most people would think should achieve an easy victory, is now faced with a quagmire. Or am I seeing something that is not there, Larry?
No, that's 100% correct. The two things, what happens, I think, is that two things get ignored. The thing that doesn't get ignored is the military calculus. In all of those instances, someone who's making a political decision about whether we should be somewhere or not be somewhere, you know, they look at their advisors, and their military advisors will always show them a calculus that's, you know, in any, if you will, empire-oriented situation where you're extending yourself into another geographic regions, any country that's attempting to do that has a strong military. And so their military, you'll get an opinion that says, well, of course we can take over their cities. Of course we can do this. We can do that. Hey, here's the calculus. Here's their armed forces. That's a given. So first of all, they look at it in a very positive light based on their military advice. Mm-hmm. What they never, ever look at are the cultural aspects of the situation, which involves the religious aspect. But it's the overall, how firmly are these people going to be opposed to what we're trying to do or the regime we're trying to support, or, mm-hmm. you know, What's the cultural context for this? And they totally ignore in anthropology what's called the territorial imperative.
Okay.
Which is a demonstrated factor that if in any equation like that, people that are defending their home territory, their home, you know, what they view as ours, have an added plus on their side. Mm-hmm. They're going to fight harder. And that gets ignored in every place that you mentioned, whether it's, you know, any empire expanding, the expansion of the Soviet Union. When you look at how it fell apart, it didn't fall apart over just communism. It fell apart because it had been overlaid on a lot of regional cultures and religious systems that were adverse to what was coming out of Moscow. British in India, French and Indochina, U.S. and Indochina, Afghanistan. It goes on and on.
See, this is why in a recent discussion with John Perkins, I'm sure you're aware of him, the guy who wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You know, I had him on and we were discussing how much more intelligently, actually, China has conducted its warfare, for lack of a better phrase here, regarding the fact that they haven't gone in with the big stick of the military. They haven't gone into the quagmires as of late. They've gone in with what is more intelligent to me when it comes to the domination and subjugation of resources and people with the economic warfare. And it just seems to me as though China figured out what it seems like every other large, you know, power on the planet has not been able to figure out for the past couple hundred years regarding
They did, Chuck, but now they're becoming corrupted by their military superiority.
Mm-hmm.
If the policies that they were following were all economic support, building bridges with their new initiatives connecting China through the Middle East to Africa, all looked like they had very strong futures.
Right.
But now that they have become so much more belligerent militarily and so much more powerful, I think that's one of the problems you always face is if the leadership is looking at the economic side, trade, if you will,
mm-hmm.
It's one thing. But if they get sucked into becoming like a international global superpower militarily, it tends to overweigh that other approach because it's easy, right? We don't have to work at it. We just tell people what we want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Xi and China are building such a colossal. I mean, before 20 years back, it was all self-defense. You know, it was all oriented towards preventing any incursion into China. We don't need a huge nuclear force, whatever. That's all gone by the boards.
Well, now we'll
be able to project our military clout across the Pacific,
right?
Globally with hypersonic strike weapons. Yeah, you didn't even need that. You know, if you're just going to focus on economic influence and trade, but it's a trap.
It's a trap. But the beauty of it is that they were able to build a thriving economic system, partially based on an idealism that was about self-defense, and also sacrifice yourself in the machine of slave labor, basically, because this is what must be done to build a China that cannot be broken by outside invaders, right? So it was a different. A lot of people forget about that when they look at the slave labor situation and the fact that people were, you know, basically volunteering themselves to, you know, horrible situations in order to build what today has a thriving middle class. Honestly, is, you know, as much as people want to call it a completely communist system, it is not. It is a hybrid and does contain a totalitarian superstructure. But it's not quite the classic totalitarianism. Anyway, I don't want to devolve into a discussion about China, at least not today. Maybe we can do that another time. Okay. But it's interesting to me because, after all, it is an idealism. It is a faith in the system or something which is of a higher power, a higher calling, a higher purpose, right, that you create a drive toward nationalism. And with that, now we go to my last treacherous piece, and I'm going to let you go completely unmolested here because this to me is the key element, again, greatly ignored by those who are allegedly analyzing it right now, who could do themselves a huge favor if they got Larry Hancock to help them out. Because here's the thing. I haven't discussed this with you. Not really. But I know that you're going to now enlighten the audience about something that I see that I cannot believe is being ignored here. And it has to do, just bear with me another minute or two here, it has to do with this connection. It's not just Putin, the great strong man, and yes, he had a wonderful PR campaign, and he is the manliest of men, and he is the greatest of leaders. Yes, great leader has been propped up among Russian culture, among the Russian psyche. Russian nationalism is very much built upon great leader Putin. But it's not just that, because he is connected directly and is motivating the population, partially based, at least partially, if not very much heavily based. It's not just great leader, but see, great leader has God on his side. And it's strange to me that people that would argue about the religiosity connected to an ISIS or some of the Islamic groups out there that we were combating for a long time in the war on terror, which nobody talks about anymore, because I guess we're not conducting that anymore. But, you know, they would talk about how that religiosity, that theocracy, that combination of overwhelming power over a population and less than rational connection to religiosity is very dangerous. And yet, whether they are pro or anti-Russian regarding the general analysis currently, the talking heads out there don't even really want to touch, for the most part. Not 100% ever, because, look, we still have the ability to have differing opinions in the United States, despite what they've told you. But in the West, I don't see really good exposés explaining how Russian nationalism at this point, via Putin or with Putin as a figurehead, is inexorably connected to the Russian Orthodox Church and a greater mission, which, look, this is where things get very dangerous, very extreme. When you are on a mission from God, so to speak, I know I'm being very blunt and sloppy about the way I'm putting this, but I'm going to let you clean it up, Larry, okay? When you're on a mission from God, and also it is for, you know, because, you know, they say it's for God and country. There's a reason why they put God first. And if God and country are linked together, then you are on a crusade of sorts. You're there for not only the greater good and the support of your neighbors and the survival of your culture. And by the way, Russians don't see themselves as just another white group. You know what I mean? They're not just another group of white people. Even though within the nation state of Russia or the Russian Federation, you will find way more white nationalist groups than you will in, any other place on the planet. If you take a look at the amount of, I'm not kidding, by the way, look at white nationalist groups that believe themselves, you know, to have that ideology. There are a great many of them that we're not reading their propaganda because it's written in Russian. Okay. Just telling you that's a reality. But they don't see themselves necessarily as just, you know, another white person, part of the great master white race. They are indeed Russians, and they have a special relationship with God through the Russian Orthodox Church. And I know that this could be a really ugly thing filled with pitfalls for you to discuss, Larry, but I think it's necessary to address here because it is an underlying and absolutely intense piece of the motivation here for how it is the population, regardless of body counts and everything else, even though we're hearing that there is some pushback and yes, indeed, they're sanitizing or shutting down oppositions or criticisms or whatever else, there is an overwhelming force here that is connected to religion that is not being reckoned with by all these people claiming to analyze the total of the situation. So I would like you to go through that and give somebody an idea. Maybe they're saying, well, wait, what does the Russian Orthodox Church have to do with this? Well, if you listen to the people that represent them and speak on their behalf, and you listen to Putin and you listen to the way these things are constructed, it seems to me as though we're not just talking about a strong-armed dictator. We're talking about a guy who runs the country because God is on his side, according to the church, and he's on the church's side as well. They're connected. So how is this being ignored, one? And two, is this not kind of a hypocritical thing where people that would normally say that a theocratic, totalitarian circumstance is something to be admonished, discouraged, disrupted, is not good for the people, is all these things that they would say if this was a Muslim nation under Sharia law with, you know, fatwas and holy wars to be offered, if this was a group of people that felt themselves to be a superior race but also had a religious element to it that ties it to something that is akin to, if not directly, a legitimate mainstream religion, if they're out there cleansing the world for Jesus or for Muhammad or for, and by the way, this has nothing to do with, you know, somebody listening might say, okay, this is offensive to people who believe in these. No. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that when you have a holy war motivation, you have a government which is now not, you know, not secular, but connected to a religious order, is this not inexorably more dangerous, provides a different motivation, and is it not being ignored by, again, most of the people analyzing this circumstance and talking about, you know, look at this. A small nation is resisting the Russian bear. They talk about maybe Putin is sick. Maybe the Russian Empire is not as tightly wound as they thought. Maybe he doesn't have all the control that they thought he had. Is he attempting to just, for the sake of history, reassemble the Russian Empire? Some of his own people have said that, by the way, not just me. But anyway, how do we study and examine this religious element, which I think is undeniable and is so consequential? What do you say to that, Larry?
I think the reason it's not getting the attention it might is that it's so easy to get wrapped up in the military situation. Russian airstrikes on the infrastructure in Ukraine, you know, torture, all the things that relate just to the activity in Ukraine. That what is not, and the other thing is that if you looked at the statements that came out of ISIS, mm-hmm. they came from one PR outlet. I mean, you had one leader saying, our mission from God is to overthrow corrupt Western culture.
The unclean foreign invaders, right.
You know, this mm-hmm. is our mission, mm-hmm. okay? And it was from one source, and it was easy to see. Now, the interesting thing is our mainstream media covers Putin. They right. don't cover a lot of the people that are essentially competing with Putin for influence. I mean, they're high figures in his administration, but the former president of Russia before Putin is on record as saying, and recently, exactly the same thing, that Russia is at war with the West. It's not about Ukraine. Ukraine was simply a beachhead, if you will. Mm-hmm. The Western culture is corrupt. It allows all sorts of cultural values, homosexuality, all sorts of sins that the pure nature of Russian civilization would not allow or endorse.
Well, even in recent days,
are being,
yeah, even in recent, you know, days, we saw a law passed in Russia, right, that specifically addressed this, and we heard rhetoric exactly matching what you're saying regarding this from not just Putin, but this was, you know, the others, right, that are making the laws there. And we had an anti-LGBTQ thing where they said this is an invasion, a disease, basically, that is coming from the United States. And they even made some statement, again, loose translation, about, you know what, if you're going to be this corrupted, spiritually filthy individual, let them live there. Let them stay there. Let them not infect us. And that was like almost literally what was said. I mean, I'm a little loose with the translation, but I know I'm not inaccurate with the way I'm representing this. And we saw that even in recent days. It's not just back to the time when there were demonstrations and, you know, Pussy Riot's going to jail and so on and so forth. That's a band. I'm not saying anything odd there. You know what I'm talking about here.
Those people are talking about moving Russian, there's just no argument in their mind.
Right.
Russian culture is superior. Russian culture is pure. The West is not. And right. It is, Russia has a mission, as you said, from God. It's their role on Earth at this point in time is to resist and to unify opposition to Western culture, mm-hmm. which obviously makes it easy for them to extend their all aspects of their relationship to Iran, to China, which has increasingly begun to demonize Western culture, to North Korea. It's a new anti-West, Western culture nexus. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to call it tripartite or whatever. It's a cultural alliance that's really opposed to the West, and the West is a threat. And the expressions and terms they use, quite frankly, are very little. You could take many of those statements those people are making, and they would have gone into ISIS PR releases. You know, that's just the way it is. Even more recently, within the last two or three days, mm-hmm. I have read essentially statements from military advisors and from regime advisors to Putin that are saying, you know, your mistake was essentially to deal with Ukraine. No, we have to recognize this as a full-scale war. Mm-hmm. We have to take Poland. You know, we have to advance our sphere of influence to the West. You know, yeah, sure, we got to take Ukraine. And by the way, those people are advocating is nuclear strikes against Ukraine.
Right.
So I don't want to be a fear monger in that regard, but the bottom line is the special political operation that Putin envisioned mm-hmm. as being easy and simple as some of the other things he's done as in Georgia or Belarus didn't work, which is given an opening to these people that have far more radical. Putin agrees with them, of course, but they're willing to go to far more radical extremes than he was, or at least to talk about it. How strongly they believe that, we will not know. We know ISIS would have pulled the trigger if they could. Mm-hmm. If these people managed to take Putin out of the picture, would they pull the trigger? Hard to judge. Today, right. Putin himself issued a statement saying 15% of the Russian population need psychological treatment. Wow. Now, that's kind of an interesting thing. Again, we're moving back towards the model of kind of like the Soviet state model of, you know, the state has to defend itself against its own citizens.
Right, and you need to be re-educated.
You know, which is sort of frightening. But so mm-hmm. certainly there is a religious aspect to it. But I would say it's not just strictly Orthodox religion. It's a worldview that is basically anti-Western in nature. Putin also made a statement earlier this week, essentially internally, that said, look, I made a mistake. You know, mm-hmm. we made a mistake. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, we essentially got into bed with the West. We looked at their economic model. We took their money. We looked at their open society. Right. And they spread all sorts of essentially cultural diseases and contaminated us. Mm-hmm. Now we have to restore purity. And I tell you what, purity, when you start talking about restoring purity, it scares me more than just plain religion.
Well, I'll tell you why I absolutely agree with what you're saying here, and I'm still astounded that this is not being addressed by all these analysts and again, the talking heads that are out there that, you know, are among the most venerated at it, right? The people, for a look at this, we're gonna go to this guy who actually knows about this stuff, you know, we're gonna go to this person that lived in Russia and was a consulate, whatever. Okay. They do all that, but they don't address this, and I think it's extremely important. I mean, I'll just give you a quick anecdote. As somebody wrote, you know, people write to me on occasion, give me show ideas. You know this, right? You need to do a show on this or that or the third thing. So in a back and forth with somebody who wanted me to focus on this, which I was going to do with you anyway, okay? I didn't need them to tell me, but I wanted to come back to you on this because you wrote about it so eloquently in Creating Chaos, which, again, is a one of the highly recommended books written by Larry Hancock, and guess how many of them I recommend? All of them. But the point is that this one happens to focus on some very pertinent information that relates to what we're seeing unfold right now. Anyway, the thing is, this show idea got batted back and forth, and I finally said, you know what, we could play a game called ABC right now, where I could read a statement and have the audience guess A, B, or C. Did this come from Nazi propaganda, ISIS, or Russia? When you take a look at some of the things that have been said and the statements and the phrasing used here, and I think that right now no one is recognizing that there is a religiosity connected to this, that there is the idea of superiority connected to this. As much as they're saying they're denazifying, Ukraine, all right, which, look, I'm not saying that there's no water in that bucket, but I'm saying that there's not a lot. The point is, as much as they're saying that, I bet that I could confuse many an audience member who doesn't try and cheat and use Google as to what regime some of these statements are coming out of, some of the ideas are coming out of, because there is a superiority, an idea that they have been contaminated or attacked by outside cultures aside from their own. Okay, so you have xenophobia, you have the connection, the mission from God, and you have the greater holy war that is being conducted against the corrupt, whether it is in a direct fashion in Ukraine, or it is against the West, or at certain points these other people would say, again, against the West. Some people might say it's against communism. Okay, different people in the ABC bucket there, Larry, right? But the statements, the phrases, the concepts are the same. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, Vladimir Putin is Adolf Hitler. Not at all. But it's interesting that they both felt a right to take Poland. It's interesting that some of their statements might be not too dissimilar from one another when it comes to why is this happening, great leader? Okay, so that's my statement. Larry Hancock does not have to agree or even be associated with my statement. That's my concept. The question to you, and the last thing, again, is very simple, and that is, why do you think this is being ignored? Is it even more frightening than the looming threat of nuclear war and that possibility, which the media was willing to bandy about for a little bit but has suddenly gone kind of quiet regarding it? Is it more frightening than the concept, than the possibility of nuclear war, that we might indeed be faced with, you know, not the extremist insurgents or small faction within another nation somewhere, or a long dead, right, idealistic enemy that's on the greater mission to cleanse land of the unwanted and undesirable? And again, I just went ABC, right? And tell me which one's which. Here we go. Is it because that is a more frightening concept, or do you have another idea about why this is not being focused on? And by the way, before I let you answer, I remind everybody, go to larry-hancock.com. Perhaps he'll blog about this discussion. I don't know if you will, Larry. But I would very much love it if you expanded upon it a little more in writing. I know you have had some things to say about this, and I'm always looking forward to any analysis you give to us regarding the political battles on the planet, the propaganda, of course, the covert actions, and the overt actions that are military. I mean, I love your analysis of all of this, and as I don't know if you qualify directly as a historian, but you are one of my favorite historians. So go over to larry-hancock.com, and I'll give you some other relevant links in the show notes tonight, you the listener. But Larry, what do you think is motivating this lack of coverage regarding this, and why are we not seeing it coherently presented to the public as, look, this is literally what the world in essence is facing, whether it's Europe or it's the United States, as being in the crosshairs, as being one of the most prolific producers of that, which is, you know, the enemy culture, the diseases that are invading and infecting Russian culture, which is superior. Why is it that we're not seeing that expounded upon by the people that are allegedly analyzing it and willing to threaten us with the idea even of global thermonuclear war, you know, willing to threaten us with the idea of a World War III breaking out in real time and all that, but not willing to approach this subject, it seems like, or maybe it's just my false impression. What are your thoughts about that? And then we'll let you go because we're actually just a touch over the time that I have you booked for, but we do have a couple minutes. So, you know, the unfair question did continue and I asked three instead of two. So what do you think it is that's making that happen? Because that's not Vladimir Putin keeping it quiet. Go ahead.
No, I think the answer really lies in what the media has evolved to in the last couple of decades. It's almost like a systems problem is the way I see it. I mean, you really have three sets of media anymore as far as cable TV or broadcast TV or that sort of thing. You have news. Everything is the Situation Room. It's I'm reporting on what has happened today.
Not just Wolf Blitzer, but yeah.
Last 5 minutes, yeah. You know, it's contemporary news and tomorrow I won't even talk about it. You know, I'm live streaming news and that takes up most of the comment. The other thing is that we have become obsessed with political news at a level that it would have been hard to imagine. I mean, go back 30 or 40 years ago and you tell me if the national media and political news would be covering what happened in at a county level in Arizona in terms of certifying election results. Now it's a headline on CNN.
No, that would have been barely worthy of the Daily Shopper or whatever in the local town a few years back. That's the truth of it. Yeah. Go ahead.
We've become obsessive about political news. And so if you turn on a channel, okay, any given mainstream channel, you know, you're either going to get local news at certain sections or you're going to get international news and, okay, that 10 minutes is gone. And then a lot of the rest of it is political, right. Certainly on the national networks. So the time reserved for the kind of longer-term commentary that you're looking at is gone. Mm. Maybe you find it on 60 Minutes. Maybe you find it. Social media is totally the same way unless you follow particular outlets and that are third- or fourth-tier outlets, if you will, that talk about these sorts of things. But they don't have the national media list. So you hear about it here, Chuck. We're discussing it.
Of course.
But we don't – the national media has evolved to the point where large-scale strategic questions about should we be somewhere, you know, where do they show up? NPR? Yeah, okay. Everybody here listen. We have dumbed ourselves down to the larger-term strategic questions because we're so much immersed in – what happened in the last 5 minutes.
Okay. With that,
I think that's a big part of it.
Okay. With that, you've provoked a final yes or no sort of question here, and just bear with me. I'm sorry. I said two questions. I've turned it now into four. But this is the last thing, and I'm just curious. I believe I could rightfully and without, you know, breaking any confidences say that that you would identify yourself as a Christian, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Do you believe that there is any element here of, because we have a significant Christian media even, that I'm sure would not want to touch it because it could indeed turn around and make it look like there is a sort of an evil Christianity at play here. So I would understand them avoiding it. But the yes or no is this. Do you think that it would become too heated of a topic for the allegedly secular mainstream corporate media? I mean, independents can, you know, if you're truly independent, you can discuss whatever you want. But if you're a larger corporate structure, do you think maybe the avoidance has something to do with not wanting to get in business of maybe being tagged by, say, the Christian media or people that are sensitive or could be triggered based on a willingness to defend Christianity as, well, we don't want to present this as something that could be like an evil Christian mission because we are trying to ascribe evil to Vladimir Putin. But if his mission is in part a Christian mission, maybe this would be the problem. I know it's a controversial, nasty question, but what the hell? It's my last pitch at you for the night. I'm going to throw the kitchen sink at you. Here's my slider. What do you think? Is that a possibility that we're looking at? It's too hot to look at the element that could be religiosity that would have to be labeled Christian that could put us in a position of seeming to be an anti-Christian broadcasting outlet that's attacking Christianity directly. Do you think that that's any sort of consideration here among the greater corporate Western media?
I do, Chuck, but probably not in the way precisely you laid it out. Here would be my high-level view.
Okay.
Again, it used to be that there were three things that you didn't discuss at the Thanksgiving dinner table, even if your radical uncle brought it up.
Right.
You didn't discuss race.
Right.
You didn't discuss, going along with that, elements of diversity, like who's dating who and who married who. That was off the table. That didn't get discussed. You got sent out of the room. You didn't discuss politics. Okay. Now, that's part of everyday's headlines. The one thing that doesn't get touched, just as a generic, is religion.
Still.
I think that's still off the table. Whether it's Christian or it kind of links partly to the diversity issue, you know, mm-hmm. that we don't want to get enmeshed in diversity by saying one something is evil and something isn't. But I think religion is off the media table.
Still.
So I think that's the answer to your question is yes, but I think again it's we're kind of doing it to ourselves. Now, I will say I absolutely believe that the people that really professionally assess this sort of thing and assess, you know, how if Putin were to be taken out of power by the wrong people, I think those assessments are occurring within the intelligence community. And that is the only thing that would be driving the European nations to this sudden huge spurt in military spending that would be driving Poland to, I mean, none of that makes any sense if they didn't think it could get dramatically worse overnight.
Yeah.
It's driving Turkey. Probably people haven't been following it, but while Turkey has tried to be an intermediary with Russia, we're seeing more and more Turkish weapon systems.
Mm-hmm.
Going into Ukraine.
Well, that nagging need for self-preservation, okay, and the possibility that this situation could radically and almost instantaneously shift against some of these places, like Poland being noted as a target of, well, you know, we should reincorporate them back into the Russian system. If I were in charge of anything in Poland, I might, you know, want to participate in anything that would resist that if I wanted to maintain independence, you know. Turkey, who has tried to sort of play both sides of the equation off and on, and I think that is their general sort of political default and military default regarding a lot of issues, might be, you know, looking realistically, hey, you know, if we don't participate in this, we could actively be undermining our own will to survive independently. So it makes perfect sense, but I'm very glad that you gave me the time to analyze this and go through this in a realistic and actually independent fashion. I almost said independent media fashion, but you're not a member of the independent media. You are an independent thinker, and a great one at that, and a great analyst. So I appreciate you taking the time to do this with us tonight, and I think we just got a very treasured and rarefied look from a sober and honest analyst, and I really appreciate it. Larry Hancock. Go to larry-hancock.com. Check out all that, and check out any writing that is accredited to Larry Hancock, whether he's the author, the co-author, or it's just a blog, it doesn't matter. It's all worth an examination. And I'll tell you this, anytime I look at anything that Larry wrote, presented, or otherwise, I always learn something, and I believe all of you can too. So Larry, thanks once again. Any like sort of final quip you want to throw at me here?
No, I appreciate getting to talk about this, because your perception is true, that we're becoming so mired down in this, in the media, about what's going on in Ukraine, that the broader story of, well, let's face it, I hate to be harsh, but let's put it this way. We learned a lesson in World War II that appeasement does not work. I hate to say it, but I don't want to sound radical, but appeasement still doesn't work.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there may be other lessons that, Vladimir Putin may have to learn some of the lessons of empire that I talked about earlier that don't seem to have been learned. But we may also have to learn some other lessons, or relearn them once again, from wider conflicts that are motivated in a particular fashion. And I think that's of key importance. Again, Larry Hancock, go to larry-hancock.com, and anytime you see anything written by him, guess what? It's got my stamp of endorsement on it. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks to Albert Lanier for the first hour of the show. And thanks to all of you. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.